This week on The Take, we're marking 1 year since a pair of devastating earthquakes hit Turkey and Syria with a new digital interactive. Listen and watch stories of survival, recovery, and coping with the grief at aljazeera.com/earthquakes. Again, that's aljazeera.com/earthquakes.
1 year into the civil war in Sudan, what is it about this story? The humanitarian costs have been staggering, but the news coverage has been minimal. Silencing the voices of dissent at U.S. universities over Israel and Gaza, and what that says about freedom of speech in America. Plus, restoring the independence of state-owned news outlets in Poland has not gone according to plan. Last week marked the first anniversary of the war in Sudan. The death toll there is in the tens of thousands. But it is in the number of people displaced, nearly 9 million, and in need of humanitarian aid, around 25 million, that this story really stands out. A conflict on this scale should top the news agenda, but it has been relegated to the back pages, in part because of what is happening in Gaza and Ukraine. And it is increasingly difficult to deny that the lack of media interest in this war comes down to where it is being fought and how it is understood. Then there's the framing that this is a war between two generals, men in uniform, which obfuscates the role of global players in the fighting and creates the perception that there are only two choices available. It is a binary that implicitly excludes a third option, one that civil society in Sudan has been fighting for decades, democracy.
We are really looking at human suffering on a scale that we can't really quantify.
It is the worst humanitarian crisis. The number of people displaced, the number of people hungry. We're essentially looking at the collapse of a society, an entire state in front of our eyes.
There's also this sense that this war is not going to end. A war that was once touted to only take a few weeks now looks like it will go on for the long term.
How is it that 1 year into Sudan's civil war, the world's gravest humanitarian crisis, attracts so little news coverage? The suffering in Gaza has been horrendous. Ukraine is an ongoing tragedy. But neither of those conflicts are on the scale of what has unfolded in Sudan, the number of people affected. And yet the story goes largely untold on global news outlets.
The lack of coverage that we see in Sudan is tied to much larger questions of how Africa is represented. And so many of these conflicts are seen in such simplistic and actually deeply harmful ways that are tied to quote-unquote primordial grievances and are somehow just localized and detached from the rest of the world.
Is that these two generals and their lust for power have taken the country hostage?
That is patently untrue. Unfortunately, we see a conflict arena that is taking shape with Gulf countries, namely the UAE and Saudi, with even Wagner mercenaries on the ground from Russia. And so what we really see is a deeply internationalized conflict that this somewhat racist media narrative really doesn't capture.
People use Gaza as an excuse. Gaza happened 6 months into the conflict. People use Ukraine as an excuse. That's a completely different setup. So the typical excuses, I don't think, hold water. I think there's a sense of let's just leave them to it. There's also a sense from the United States that one of their key allies in the region, the UAE, might be doing things that would feed this war, and they don't want to put too much pressure on the UAE because, well, they don't want to lose that very key ally.
It has been 5 years to the month since the Sudanese people were given cause for hope with the downfall of the dictator Omar al-Bashir, who ruled over them for 30 years. The civilians who rose up against al-Bashir then saw their dream of a democracy dashed by a military coup, which morphed into a civil war last year when an insurgent army from Western Sudan, the RSF, tried to take power from the generals in Khartoum, the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF. This power struggle is being fueled by players on the outside. Backing the SAF is Egypt and, more recently, Iran. In the RSF's corner is Russia, through its mercenary force, Wagner, and the United Arab Emirates, although the Emiratis have tried to obscure their own agenda. Last year, Emirati state media claimed that this was humanitarian aid destined for the Sudanese people. But according to investigations by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, it was all a guise to smuggle in arms to the RSF, accusations that the UAE has repeatedly denied.
Now, of course, some of what has gone to Sudan has been humanitarian assistance, but as is also well known, that there are lots of other things such as armored cars, laser-guided missiles, and drones, which have also been going to the region. So this idea that they're purely humanitarian while sending literal weapons is clearly not exactly such a neat and tidy story, and I don't think they're fooling too many people, least of all Sudanese on the ground.
In terms of what the UAE is after in Sudan, the gold trade, which is incredibly important for various reasons. One of them is sanction evasion. The United Arab Emirates cooperates with the Africa Corps, formerly Wagner, which is a direct projection of Russia's interest. And for Russia, gold is incredibly important to finance the war in Ukraine and to make its own economy less dependent on the dollar. So it needs resources that are more resistant towards sanctions, and that's where gold comes in.
What the UAE has become over certainly the past decade is the banking hub of the region. Countries that have either despotic or autocratic entities will invariably do some business in the United Emirates, particularly in the gold sector. And it just so happens that the RSF is one of the biggest clients of the UAE, which of course has one of the world's biggest gold markets.
In the early stages of the information war, the RSF captured the national state-run TV channel near Khartoum. Last month, the SAF took it back. But when the RSF was in control, it didn't really do much with the channel. Partly because even in a country dealing with large-scale internet blackouts, where just 30% of the population can consistently get online, social media is still where it's at. The UAE is also involved in that side of things. Some of the companies behind pro-RSF social media channels, like GSK, are based in the Emirates. They portray the militia group's leader, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti, as a legitimate president in waiting. They have their work cut out. In 2014, Hemeti's forces fighting in the war in Darfur committed mass murders and rapes of civilians, atrocities they are continuing to carry out, sometimes posting the evidence online. Other insiders trying to rehabilitate Hemeti's image and meddle with the news narrative in Sudan range from operatives working out of Russia in the east to Canada in the west.
What we have now on the information space is, I guess, the culmination of years of investment by the RSF in different PR firms across the world, not just in the United Arab Emirates, but also famously the Canadian-Israeli firm run by the former Israeli intelligence agent Ari Ben-Menashe, which had been providing PR help to the RSF for several years before the war.
Externally, the idea is to sort of wash and clean the reputation of the RSF, to position Hemeti as somebody who can be taken seriously as the head of state, because ultimately the prize here is the nation of Sudan. So that's what that propaganda has been about. Internally, it's about trying to sow division. It's about trying to get more support for the rapid support forces over the Sudanese armed forces.
Whenever there was an airstrike by the Sudan armed forces that had civilian casualties, you'd have someone from the RSF filming it and decrying, denouncing the Sudan armed forces. What we've also been seeing a lot lately is defections or alleged defections from the Sudan armed forces or local militia that have joined them. We can't, of course, say in how far they are staged, whether or not these have been taken under duress.
Too often, the coverage this war does get falls into the binary trap, which makes it easier for the international community to just look away.
That this is essentially a war between two generals.
Between Hemeti of the RSF versus the SAF's Abd al-Fattah al-Burhan, a reductive characterization of what is happening.
The fighting is taking place between army units loyal to the two generals. You can see.
But Sudan's story is far bigger than them. Sudanese resistance committees, grassroots neighborhood networks of ordinary citizens who coordinated online, were crucial in bringing about the downfall of Omar al-Bashir in 2019 and have been working to save civilian lives since the war began. They have every right to demand a democratic say in what comes next for Sudan, and more of the news cameras should be pointed their way.
Framing the story around these two generals who are fighting falls into a number of traps and tropes about the region. Firstly, this idea that these African countries are somehow recklessly ruled and all about these warlords goes into this narrative, which are really problematic and really short-sighted because they fail to really think about the internationalized dimensions that are related to all of this. And more than anything, they take away the agency of those who've been on the ground, these civic activists who led this revolution and overthrown the Omar al-Bashir, this deeply kleptocratic regime.
The thing that gives me hope is that the very people that fought for the revolution, they're the same people on the ground who are living the very values that they fought for. The emergency response rooms, the resistance committees, the infrastructure that they are building, complete the very democracy that they're talking about, is happening in Sudan right now in the most intense, difficult conditions. They are making it happen. That is the real story.
In the United States, nationwide student protests against Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza have set off police violence and a toxic media debate. Tarek Nafa is here with more.
Well, for weeks now, students have been staging sit-ins across US campuses at universities like Columbia, Brown, and MIT, and they're spreading. However, if you've been watching the extensive news coverage of those demonstrations, you could be forgiven for not knowing what the students are actually demanding, that their universities divest or sever links with companies and academic institutions that profit from Israel's occupation and apartheid.
College campuses in several parts of the country are struggling tonight with just where to draw the line between allowing protests and free speech and preventing anti-Semitism and intimidation.
The focus of the coverage has been on alleged anti-Semitism and the safety of Jewish students. We've also seen politicians in the media demonizing protesters with baseless claims like this one.
Some of these students apparently are unaware of the atrocities of October 7th. They deny that women and children were brutally raped and murdered, that infants were placed into ovens and cooked alive.
Narratives that have even been debunked by Israeli news outlets. One of the ironies at play when examining the coverage, Columbia University, which has spearheaded this movement, has one of the world's oldest journalism schools. It administers the Pulitzer Prize for excellence in the field. Faculty there staged a walkout over the university's heavy-handed security response. 54 law professors sent a letter to Columbia's leadership, urging it to respect the rule of law values that we teach and cherish, and added the extraordinary involvement of the police threatened the university's legitimacy within its own community and beyond its gate. The videos and accounts of peaceful sit-ins being met with police violence, of students being arrested after university leaders called security forces in to deal with them, have exposed how repressive the debate over Gaza has become in the US. And it's about freedom of speech and whether US academic institutions will stand up for the values they teach and which American politicians preach.
Thanks, Tarek. For more than 4 months now, Poland's new government, led by Prime Minister Donald Tusk, has been out to reverse the wholesale changes made to the country's media by the previous government, which had held power for 8 years. During that time, when the Law and Justice Party was in office, media legislation was passed that dramatically altered the journalistic landscape and enhanced the ruling party's control over publicly owned news outlets, most notably at the state-owned television network, TVP. But the Tusk government's goal to sterilize public broadcasting of partisan politics has not been fully embraced by Polish society. TVP's ratings are down, and it has lost viewers to a relatively new right-wing channel, TV Republika. The Listening Post's Ryan Coles now on Donald Tusk's media overhaul and how it's unfolding in Poland.
It was December 2023, just 1 week since a new government came to power in Warsaw. And then Poland's state broadcaster TVP was suddenly taken off the air.
Tego jeszcze w polskiej historii nie było. Zostały po prostu chyba przejęte polskie media.
Just what happened that night? It depends on who's narrating the tale and which side of Poland's political rift they're on.
TVP was unlawfully shut down in an instant. Dozens, even hundreds of employee passes stopped working. One of the editors decided that the presenter should inform viewers that the TVP is being unlawfully taken over at the moment. He only managed to say a few sentences before the signal was cut off.
It was a big relief for many people in Poland because public media needs to be impartial. And for 8 years, public media was everything but impartial. The populist party, Law and Justice, was slicing democracy cut by cut. Tusk decided to stop it immediately. So obviously for anybody, it is like a shock therapy.
Poland's new prime minister, Donald Tusk, was the man administering this shock therapy to the state media.
Zadaniem, jakiego się podjęliśmy, to jest zadanie przywrócenia normalności, jakiejś takiej elementarnej równowagi i przyzwoitości w mediach publicznych.
The new government came into power in December last year, and reforming the media was at the top of its agenda. The coalition is center-left and pro-EU, replacing the right-wing government headed by the Law and Justice Party, known in Poland by its acronym PiS. For 8 years, from 2015 until 2023, PiS was in power, and in that time it had a transformative effect on the country's media. It politicized Poland's media regulators, turned the national broadcaster into what the Council of Europe called a propaganda channel for the ruling party. Private media outlets were either bought out by local governments or state corporations, or private conglomerates allied to PiS. Regulations and laws came into effect that made the survival of critical media outlets incredibly challenging.
So when the former government, the Law and Justice government, left office, public media in particular had been completely corrupted. The main public TV channels was used to promote the government's agenda, attack its opponents. The main evening news every day would generally involve promoting the government's narrative.
Bo dzisiaj zatrzymanie tej lewackiej ideologii LGBT gender, która wchodzi do szkół, wchodzi do przedszkoli, wchodzi w nasze umysły. Ja nawet widzę kredki, jakieś
kolorowe kredki
są po prostu wszystko po prostu w tych tęczowych barwach.
The channel was attacking the opposition, usually in a very unsubtle way.
Donald Tusk tuż po przejęciu władzy w Platformie Obywatelskiej, zresztą w sposób nie mający wiele wspólnego z demokratycznymi standardami, uruchomił nowy front politycznej wojny w Polsce.
Wyglądało trochę jakby...
What happened to TVP sounds like a story from some strange place that knows no democracy.
Nie mieliśmy już tych samych...
However, the laws regarding how management teams are chosen for public TV had been changed by PiS back in 2015, when they came to power. And those are the laws Tusk made use of. Before the changes, there was regulation to ensure the selection of management personnel wasn't purely political. It was all done according to EU standards. When PiS changed the law, it enabled politicians to directly appoint and dismiss the managers of public media outlets.
Ale którym zasiadają aktywni politycy?
Tusk had come to power promising to depoliticize public media, but many argue he's really just repoliticized it. TVP, for example, under the new administration, received criticism a couple of months ago when it published an advert celebrating its freedom under the new management.
Po prawie 9 latach
z powrotem jestem w telewizji publicznej.
But every single politician that was shown in that advert speaking on the channel was from the new ruling coalition, so there were no opposition voices on there.
Mają obowiązywać jedna narracja.
They want to have a single narrative. Nowadays, the immigration crisis is rarely spoken about. No one wants to discuss the risks of moving our currency from the zloty to the euro, or issues like rising energy costs. The destruction of TVP means that people are not being informed. And let me draw your attention to TVP's viewership, which is collapsing dramatically.
That is not an exaggeration. According to a survey conducted by the media analytics firm Nielsen, TVP's viewership in February 2024 had dropped by 72% compared with audience numbers in February 2023. One of the biggest media beneficiaries of TVP's nosediving numbers is a right-wing populist channel, TV Republica. Aligned with Peace, it emulates the style of Fox News in the US or CNews in France.
Zamachy terrorystyczne, wzrost przestępczości, także ataków na tle seksualnym i powszechna utrata poczucia bezpieczeństwa wśród mieszkańców zachodniej Europy to cena, jaką płacą Niemcy, Francuzi czy Szwedzi za dotychczasową politykę migracyjną.
Many peace-appointed employees who were ousted from state media upon Tuch's arrival migrated to TV Republica. And according to the Nielsen survey, the numbers of viewers in February this year was 30 times the audience just 1 year ago. Also, in February, the channel's advertising revenue quadrupled.
We contacted TV Republica to speak with them about the streak of success they're enjoying. They didn't respond. When we asked the current director of TVP, the man appointed by Tusk government, he had a very specific perspective on the falling numbers of his network and the jump TV Republica has seen.
The viewer of public media for 8 years, it was a very specific viewer, and there were people that were victims of populism. So that was obvious that they will move to TV Republica, which is very populistic. For some people, probably current public television is more boring because there are no made-up sensational things. There is no language of hatred. Basically, it became more flat. So obviously, I can understand that for some people is less excitement. But we are not here to excite people. We are here to deliver the news, the facts.
Conservative viewers should not be abandoned. After all, the idea of public media is to represent all voices in society. Of course, those who enjoy the emotions and aggression of hate speech should feel abandoned, since that language and tone has no place here. However, if TVP ignores conservatives, it doesn't mean that those people will just disappear and we can manage with just liberal media. This is really the challenge for the new government. To allow public media to be professional and independent, and not simply use it as a mouthpiece.
And that is the challenge for Donald Tusk.
Protestuję przeciwko całkowitemu ubezwłasnowolnieniu telewizji publicznej.
The promise Poland's new government made was to, quote, restore access to reliable information on public media. But if reliable ends up meaning everything that's pro-government, then the opportunity to restore balance and credibility to a degraded media landscape will be squandered, and the deep polarization in Poland will remain.
And finally, for more than 6 months now, we have reported on the countless crimes being committed by Israeli forces in Gaza. This past week, more horror stories emerged. The discovery of new mass graves. At least 392 bodies unearthed next to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Some were found stripped naked, their hands tied. Others showed signs of having been buried alive. The execution of civilians is a war crime for which the Israeli military denies responsibility. And it's not as though the UN's Human Rights Office or the European Union, both of which have called for independent investigations, are going to get one anytime soon. because Israel continues to deny the UN and human rights organizations access to Gaza, locking them out, along with scores of journalists. The Palestinian reporters and first responders inside the war zone continue to do their work despite being targeted. And it is worth remembering that they have been the ones who have brought these stories of mass graves to light. We'll see you next time here at The Listening Post.